This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Opiate use is rising nationwide, as are deaths from opiate overdoses. In North Carolina, the number of unintentional deaths from opiate overdoses more than tripled from 1999 to 2012. But there is a drug available that, if administered on time, can reverse the effects of opiate overdoses and bring people back essentially from the brink of death. The drug is popularly called Narcan, and the World Health Organization has called it essential, right up there with morphine and ibuprofen. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has urged federal law enforcement agencies to have the drug on hand and personnel trained in its use. 17 states and the District of Columbia allow everyday people to administer Narcan. Here in North Carolina, the legislature passed a bill that allows doctors and licensed medical workers to prescribe bottles of Narcan to their patients. So, what exactly is this drug? How does it work? And why isn't it readily available everywhere all the time? Joining us to talk about that is Dr. Stephen Wyatt, Medical Director for Addictions for Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System. He's been here about 10 minutes, just arrived from Connecticut. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Welcome to Charlotte, by the way. Robert Childs is Executive Director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. That's an organization engaging in grassroots advocacy, resource development, coalition building, and direct services for those made vulnerable by drug use, sex work, and overdose, among other things. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Ronald Martin works part-time as one of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition's law enforcement safety advocates. He also worked directly with politicians in the legislature to promote the passage of bills which resulted in the, is it Naloxone? Is that how you say the real name of it?
That's the generic.
Or Narcan application statutes. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Glad to be here, Mike.
And Louise Vincent is chapter president and the national vice president of the Urban Survivors Union and has been running an underground syringe exchange program for the last 8 years. She's also helped reverse hundreds of overdoses in North Carolina. Thank you for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
We'll talk about everything you all do over the course of the program, but first let's find out what we're talking about. What is an opiate or an opioid? What is it?
Opiates are a derivative of the poppy seed, and it is a pain reliever. It is transported throughout the body, but its primary effect is in the brain. Mm-hmm. It does actually cause some relief of pain, even peripherally. Opioids, on the other hand, are derivatives, sometimes semi-synthetics of an opiate, and sometimes pure synthetics, like methadone.
So an opiate would be an illicit drug, an illegal drug, and an opioid would be a legally prescribed drug?
No, not entirely.
Okay. Okay.
Morphine and codeine are both opiates.
Okay.
They're direct derivatives of the opiate plant or the poppy seed.
Heroin would be an opiate?
Heroin is a semi-synthetic, so okay. It's really an opioid.
So in a clinical setting, what would the drugs be that would be opiates or opioids in a clinical setting?
Well, I've mentioned codeine and morphine are opiates, whereas oxycodone, hydrocodone, these are semi-synthetics. And then there's fentanyl, which is a opioid that's a pure synthetic.
Now, we know that oxycodone has both a clinical use and a street use because it's on the street everywhere, and people are passing it around amongst each other. On the street, what drugs are we talking about?
We're talking about all of them, actually, on the street. So as there's been a huge increase in the prescribing of opiates for pain, primarily, over the last 20 years, really. We saw a significant increase starting in the early 1990s. And this came in part because there was an encouragement by the public and the media to treat pain appropriately. And in fact, the JACO, which is an accrediting organization for hospitals and all medical facilities in the country, made pain evaluation a significant part of people even coming into the system. And by doing that physicians had to address people's pain, and the easiest way to address it, to do something about it, was to prescribe an opiate. So we've seen this huge increase in the number of opiates being prescribed.
So just before we started the show, Doctor, you mentioned that the United States is in the 90 percentile of all of opiate use in the entire world. We use 90%. Explain that figure to me. We're one of the highest users in the world.
By far. We were way ahead of every other country in the world in terms of the prescribing of opiates.
And so this growing opiate use, is it strictly because doctors have been tasked with taking care of patients' pain and therefore have been prescribing these things at increasing frequencies? Or is it because people are self-medicating for recreational purposes or to relieve some pain that they perceive that they have, and this makes it better?
It's a combination of both. Once people are prescribed these medications, they have a tendency to take more if it's not helping their pain, and more medication then gets prescribed. It can't really be on the street necessarily without it having been made available through a physician. The majority of opiates on the street today have been prescribed by a single physician to a single person, and the majority of that is shared with either friends or family. So it's not coming through the internet. It's because grandpa had cancer, was prescribed opiates, maybe getting a couple hundred of these pills a month, would only use 30 or 40 of them, but at the end of the month would go back because the bottle was low and didn't realize that grandson was taking him out of the medicine cabinet.
So let me ask the three people who work with people who are addicted and who have overdoses of this. Does this start just like that for most of these people, that they see these extra pills laying around the house and they try one because let's see what this does, and then they become addicted, or they see out of 100 pills that grandpa had, there are 30 left. I can make some money on the street with these, and they take them. How does it work?
I mean, I think that's one way that it works. I think pills that are laying around in medicine cabinets are one way people get addicted, but I think there's tons of other ways as well. I mean, I don't think you can name that as the one way that people become addicted to different medications and different drugs.
What draws them to the drug in the first place?
Well, like in North Carolina, for example, we're seeing a lot of blue-collar workers who don't have health insurance. They get injured on the job, and then they take, you know, prescription opioids in order to self-medicate their pain because they got to put a paycheck into the bank by the end of the week to pay their rent.
They have to go back to work.
So they self-medicate. Yeah. And so we have a huge problem with that. And then a lot of people like it for the euphoria, right? Okay. So it has, you know, produces, you know, euphoria in the body, and it, you know, a lot of people do it for that. There's also, you know, a lot of people who are on hard times who may have to do sex work, and I don't know a lot of sex workers who could do it sober, so they may use opiates or opioids in order to do the work so they can feed their family, because they may have a criminal history and may not have any other options in life.
Robert, you were telling me just before we started that we have a tremendous number of people in North Carolina who are using these drugs, either because they were prescribed or because they have access to them. How big a problem is it?
It's a gigantic problem in North Carolina, and it's led to many unintentional consequences. So in North Carolina, we're seeing 1,100 people die a year right now. We're seeing, ever since, you know, they've tried to cramped down a bit on the prescription drugs, we've seen the unintended consequence of an increase in heroin use, because people still really need the drug. So they switched over to heroin, and heroin ODs doubled in 2012 in North Carolina. So it's really big concern. And the other thing that we are seeing, according to the Centers for Disease Control in 2012, is that on average, North Carolina gave out 97 opioid prescriptions per 100 people. And so it's a huge, huge problem in North Carolina. I can say I went to the dentist, I had a procedure, they gave me a prescription for 90 pills of Oxy, and I didn't need it.
So why? That seems irresponsible to me. Why would a physician, a dentist in this case, do that? Why would you prescribe so many pills? If you need 97 pills...
You don't get a call back because of a person having pain. You know, they're taken care of. That does seem hugely excessive to me as a physician. I do want to be clear, though, that the majority of people that get prescribed an opiate for pain take it appropriately and get rid of their pain and don't take any more than what was prescribed. So I don't want to come across as somehow there isn't a very, very good purpose for the prescribing of opiates. Okay. It just needs to be done judiciously.
Well, you entered, Doctor, a National Institute of Drug Abuse Clinical Research Fellowship at the Yale School of Medicine. You completed an addiction psychiatry fellowship there, and you're a past president of the Connecticut Society of Addiction Medicine. You're now with CMC. What is it about opiates and opioids that make them so addictive?
As has been mentioned, there's a euphoric event that can take place. However, that's somewhat has a genetic predisposition. So many people, including myself, take an opiate, get mildly sedated, maybe a little bit nauseated, and say, who would want to ever take these for fun? So there's a difference in how people are going to react to opiates. But there are some people that they take it for the first time, and it's like, wow, I feel like this is how everyone else feels all the time.
And if you have a successfully pleasant experience with one of these drugs, are you more likely to not only take the drug again because you want to replicate the experience, but to take more of it because you might get a better experience?
I think that's absolutely the case. And then I am a person who has a genetic predisposition for addiction. And so I have struggled with opiate addiction my whole life, from the time I was very young.
What was your first exposure and why?
Well, my first exposure to drugs was young, and that was around 13. And I don't know why. I don't know why some people, I think mental illness, sometimes a combined mental illness. But my first, I was first introduced to opiates around 20, 21. And I was just introduced on the street in combination with other drugs that I was using. But the difference with opiates is that they make you sick. And most people don't know this, but, you start using them, you like them a lot, you continue to use them, you build a tolerance, so you have to use more to get the same effect or to get any effect. And then about the time you want to stop, you realize you can't stop. So
Because
you then become, and the doctor may be able to provide a better, I'm just going to tell you get sick, and it's worse than the flu.
So, doctor, what is it? What
happens? Anytime the body is exposed to almost anything, it will try to equilibrate to it. It'll try to be normal. It wants to survive. So you put enough sedative on, like an opiate, which is a form of sedative. It's going to produce other chemicals, chemicals that will try to keep the body active, try to keep it alert. It does that. Over time, on a daily basis, it's the whole system is upregulated. Then you stop the opiate, and bingo, you're in withdrawal. And it's through norepinephrine, and mostly, which is a very stimulating drug. And so you feel very agitated. Your whole system is upset. And so it drives you then to want to take more. And that more you do get, you have a pleasurable event. But the problem is we can detox people, but we have a real difficult time keeping them off.
So when we come back from the break, I want to talk to Ronald Martin, who's a former law enforcement officer, about what he's seen on the street with people and who these people are. And then we're going to talk about this drug that reverses the effects of an overdose. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and dermatology, laser, and vein specialists of the Carolinas, providing the Charlotte region with a wide range of services for optimal skin health and wellness. Details at carolinaskin.com. Well, North Carolina is a good state for sunshine. Just look outside. It makes us a good state for solar power generation, too. In fact, solar energy went from pretty much zero about 10 or 15 years ago to the fourth largest producer of solar energy in the country here in North Carolina. It's been made possible by advancements in technology and decreases in the cost of that technology and several other things as well. But some fear that the State Utilities Commission is putting all this progress at risk. So we'll talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, there are more than 100 ballot initiatives in 41 states on issues including gay marriage, gun control, marijuana, and the minimum wage. Who's funding them and what they mean for the American political process.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Dr. Stephen Wyatt, Medical Director for Addictions and Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System. Louise Vincent is Chapter President and locally and National President of the Urban Survivors Union. Robert Childs is Executive Director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. And Ronald Martin, a former law enforcement officer, is a law enforcement safety advocate with that organization. And we're talking about opiate and opioid addiction, but mostly we're going to spend the rest of the program talking about this drug that has the ability to reverse an overdose, essentially, if it's administered in the right time. Ronald Martin, as I said, is a former police officer in New York City, NYPD, spent 20 years on the force, and in that time you supervised narcotics teams conducting street-level buy and sell programs. So that people understand who the people are that we're talking about, who get an addiction, who may be apt to get an overdose from an opiate or opioid. Mm-hmm. What did you see on the streets of New York? Who are these people?
It would be difficult to actually put a definition, to actually phrase the definition as far as who these people are. What I can tell you is that the drugs of choices typically would range anywhere from crack cocaine to what is now a high dependency upon heroin, which is tremendously on the rise. But
these are not all underprivileged people who can't find their next meal.
Far from it. Actually, you can look at a lot of the prescription drug overdoses and actually see that it's targeting typical middle-class families, just student communities where there are several colleges right now here in North Carolina where there are certain campus police departments that are going through special provisions as a means of protecting students that are being subjected to drug overdose situations.
You just used the word targeting. What do you mean?
Targeting means a means of just creating programs such as naloxone, 911 Good Sam laws, things as a means to work a harm reductive model approach towards preventing people from dying in a situation of an overdose.
I know that you're no longer a police officer, but when you were, did you have this enlightened view of what to do with people and about people who use these drugs and sometimes overdose on them?
Unfortunately, since we're on the radio, I'm going to let all of the listeners know I'm smiling right now because the answer to that question would be no. I would be probably a little bit of a revolutionary, I would say, as far as my approach that I've taken since I've retired. I was probably a very, very aggressive officer, a very, very aggressive supervisor. I worked the Organized Crime Control Bureau unit, which basically supervised people in Narcotics Bureau. So we were actually the physical entity that was responsible for arresting the possessors and the sellers of
narcotics. And you're like a linebacker. I would not want to tackle you.
I was actually quite small for my narcotics team. So we had some rather large men that were affecting, some very, very important arrests at times. But I guess the true realization is the fact that ultimately what we were doing was following a course of action that wasn't solving the problem.
Which we're going to talk about. But first I want to talk about this drug, naloxone or Narcan.
Mike, if I can interrupt for a moment. There was actually an interesting article in JAMA, the Journal of the Medical Association, that indicated the changing of the population of people using opiates over the last 20 years. And 20 years ago, it was, as is pointed out, primarily an urban drug. It was there was a 50-50 mix pretty much between the white population and non-white population. And recently, in re-looking at that epidemiology, there's been a significant shift out of the urban setting and a much wider range of individuals using this drug.
Meaning suburban? meaning
suburban, correct.
Which you've opened
And women, too.
All right, so well, you've opened a can of worms there, because that means this changing attitude that Ronald Martin just described, we're becoming more enlightened about this is a disease and not a crime, happened when it moved to the suburbs, when white people and women became more affected than African Americans and people living in an urban environment. We're changing our minds about this because of that?
Partly that, and partly the fact that that more people are using it, so there's a larger population, and also that actually the population that had formerly been using it was better educated in using them. So the potential for overdose was less.
Louise, you want to comment?
I think we're seeing at least what I see just on – I mean, not research statistics, but what you see when you're looking on the streets is a much younger group of people. So you're seeing people 16, 17, 18, their first experience with drugs being opiates. And so when you say they're not educated, they really don't have any idea what they're stepping into.
Right.
And they're sheltered under their parents' insurance, you know, so they can go to rehab and they can get some help.
How easy is it to overdose on these things? And I guess it would depend on what it is you're taking, whether it's heroin or whether it's oxycodone. But how easy is it to...
It's super easy.
If you're injecting the drug, you know, so if you're injecting heroin, I think the statistics are that more than half of people that inject heroin overdose at some time. So it's everybody that I know that has ever used,
and it's really we got really concerned when people are coming out of a prolonged period of abstinence, which could be from incarceration, drug treatment, something like that.
They shoot up their old amount, and it's too much for them.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, an AOD. Yeah, anything that made them lose tolerance.
And when you overdose, most people think of people lying there unconscious, frothing at the mouth, possibly dying. But when you overdose, do you always die? Without intervention, do you always die?
If you take enough, yes, would die.
But it's possible to recover from an overdose even without medical intervention if it's not a terrible overdose.
Correct.
Right.
Meanwhile, there is this drug that we're going to talk about called naloxone or Narcan. They're the same drug. One's a street name for it. When did that drug become available? In the 1960s, right?
Yes, it's been around a long time.
And it reverses essentially the effects of an overdose to certain substances, correct?
Correct. Naloxone is a medication that couples to the opiate receptor but doesn't activate it. So, and it has a very high affinity to the receptor, so it actually displaces the opiate. These are chemical reactions, so the opiate's kind of on and off the receptors. It goes off, the naloxone goes on. It's coupled very tightly, so it displaces the opiate. And so the person no longer has any opiate available.
So if you if somebody calls, is sent to the hospital or a medic arrives because somebody's called 911 and they have the drug with them, and they, what, inject the drug into the person who's having the overdose, that person will recover 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10?
If they catch them in time.
What's the time interval?
Well, essentially, if they have not been breathing long enough. So
it will reverse the effect?
It will reverse the effect.
So if this has been available since 1960, and now there are people like the Attorney General who are saying that this needs to be available to every law enforcement person out there, and some advocate, and in some states it is available to ordinary citizens to carry around like they'd carry a bottle of aspirin with them. As a former law enforcement officer, how are law enforcement officers today reacting to this suggestion that they have this drug available to administer to persons overdosing?
Well, the organization that Robert and I are working with, North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, we train law enforcement officers throughout the states, deputies departments, police departments. It has been received very, very positively as far as just the notion of that that someone's life can be saved. Mm-hmm. You know, having the tools and the equipment available to, you know, that's going to be with you, that can save someone's life when the time comes. Just to recount a story, in coming to the studio this morning, I was speaking to my younger brother, who's an active police officer in Nassau County, New York, which is one of the counties out in Long Island, New York. Mm-hmm. And he was stating that, you know, opiate reversals has been plentiful. I mean, it's been an abundance of them, lives being saved. And more importantly, he sees it as a definite positive thing.
To give our listeners an idea of what the ramifications of not having this drug around are, one study claims that 110 Americans on average die from drug overdoses every day, outnumbering deaths from gunshot wounds or motor vehicle crashes. Overdoses are the number one accidental killer of Americans 25 to 64 years old. A Massachusetts study found this drug, Narcan, to be 98% effective in reviving the victims of overdose. Another study found that for every 20% of heroin addicts in a population treated with the drug, about 6.5% of overdose deaths could be prevented. That seems like a wide disparity between 98% and 6.5%. In your experience, doctor, what has it been?
It's hugely effective. I had formerly been an emergency room physician, and if a person came in comatose, like they were no, there was trouble with respirations, the first three things that we would do is give them sugar, because if they if they're hypoglycemic, the brain would die if they don't have sugar. We give them oxygen, and we give them Narcan. So it's a very safe medication to be
using.
Would
you give them Narcan even if you didn't know what they were overdosing on?
Correct, because if it was an opiate overdose, it would reverse it, just as if it is that they're not breathing for whatever reason, mm-hmm. giving them oxygen would reverse it.
The World Health Organization, as I said, calls this drug essential. Robert, you helped create the largest community-based naloxone, is that how you say it?
Naloxone.
Naloxone, the distribution program in the South, and you've worked toward getting the legislature here in this state to make this drug available. The bill was Senate Bill 20. It's the South's first 911 Good Samaritan naloxone combo law and the first Republican bill mm-hmm. of its kind in the country.
Yes.
How did you get Republicans on board?
Well, it made sense for them to sponsor and support it. It's a life-saving legislation that protects the dignity of every family member of every resident of North Carolina. It was a no-brainer for them. There's no reason they shouldn't support it.
Did this bill pass?
Yes. It was one of the most popular bills in the North Carolina legislature.
So as a result of this passage, and it passed, I believe, in April,
mm-hmm.
What happens now? Who will have access to this drug? How will it be administered?
Sure. So why don't I take a quick step back and say what the law did, okay. which is Senate Bill 20. And as of April 9th, 2013, a person who seeks medical assistance for experiencing a drug overdose cannot be prosecuted for possession of small amounts of drugs or possession of drug paraphernalia if evidence for the charge was obtained as a result of the person seeking help. So the victim from these charges is protected as well.
Let me get this straight. There's no longer a threat to the person ingesting these illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
If they're calling for help, or if somebody calls for help on their behalf, they won't be arrested for possession.
They can still be arrested, which is a problem with the law, and that's why it needs to be amended, but they can't be prosecuted. Yeah. So, I mean, the intention of the law is for them not to be arrested and charged. What we are seeing on the street, which Louise can also testify to, is people are still being arrested, and if they law enforcement do arrest, it sends a message to the community that they shouldn't call 911 at a drug overdose. So the bill needs to be amended. Mm-hmm. However, it is a really good bill overall, especially with the naloxone provisions. And in Georgia, which is another Republican state, they just put arrest charge and prosecution protections in their bill. And that's something we'll be looking to amend in 2015.
So is this just for opiate and opioid overdoses that people call 911 for help on, or is it for any drug that you call 911?
The majority of drugs, yeah.
So this is a sea change. I mean, this is a real switch in the way we...
Absolutely.
What do you think the impact will be of that?
I think the impact has been tremendous. I mean, the response alone, like I said, from the law enforcement end is that of there's an opportunity to save lives, to actually respond to a scene and save lives.
all of you work to help people who have this addiction and help and have this problem, and you yourself admitted, Louise, to having this problem at some point. So what has been the reaction in the community of people who use these drugs for whatever reason, self-medication purposes, recreational highs? What has been their reaction to this law and to the availability of this reversal drug?
I mean, they're very grateful. People always want. I mean, I've never had anybody not want to have naloxone available. You know, nobody wants to watch their friends die. Nobody wants to leave the scene and leave someone dying because they're afraid to be arrested. I mean, those aren't things that people do because they are making good choices and because they want to do them. They're things they do because they're afraid and they don't know what else to do. And so that's not, you know, people are very grateful to have naloxone available.
So now when you're having a social gathering where one person may be overdoing it and overdose on this drug, you no longer have to scatter after you call 911 to save this person's life. You can stick around, but you're not going to be arrested?
Well, I don't think that's happening. It's still, and I think you have to be careful how you frame this, because when someone overdoses, someone is dead. You know, so someone, you're essentially looking at someone dead in front of you. So this is never a good time. This is never a situation where people are relaxed and, oh, right. You know. So there's still a very immediate, you know, worry and concern. So just because people have naloxone available doesn't mean they're, you know, they no longer care and the party continues and, you know, they inject the person with naloxone and everything's all good. No one wants to have naloxone injected into them. It sends you into withdrawal, so it's not something that you would want to happen.
It's an unpleasant.
It's an
experience.
Unpleasant experience. So nobody's just purposefully using.
Describe the experience.
Well, it sends you into withdrawal, and like I said earlier in the show, when you're in withdrawal, my experience has been that you feel worse than the worst flu you've ever had.
Okay. And it is important to note that you should still receive medical treatment after.
Yeah.
So it's not a situation where you just take the naloxone.
Well, when you combine this law that the legislature in North Carolina passed, and along with those in other states that have been passing, that are essentially decriminalizing this in a way, you could be arrested, but you're not going to be prosecuted if you are found to be in danger of dying. They'll come and help you, and you won't be prosecuted. Does that not give a person who is predisposed to using these drugs because they are addicted to them, which is a medical condition. It is not a criminal condition. It's a medical condition. But does it not give them carte blanche to use that? And if you know that this drug is on hand to reverse an overdose, does that not tell you subliminally, I'll be okay? So I'm going to go ahead and use this.
Did the laws ever stop people from using before? I think if you're predisposed for addiction, the laws probably don't stop you, and the naloxone certainly isn't going to affect whether you use or not.
You're a psychiatrist, and you know the mind of an addict. What would you say to that, doctor?
I don't think there's really been no evidence that it would increase the use of opiates because they have naloxone available. Again, as Louise has pointed out, it's a very uncomfortable experience to be injected with naloxone. You're thrown into immediate withdrawal. So the idea that someone would play around in a way that they would know that they're going to go into withdrawal. Now, that's not to say people, the reason we see so much overdose is because people push those limits. But I don't think that they're going to push, and there's no evidence that they're going to push the limits any greater
I only have 20 seconds in the segment, but if for somebody who's been reversed through the use of Narcan, are they likely to overdose again, or is the experience so bad that that's going to put them off their use? 10 seconds.
There's certainly a possibility that people are going to get some treatment at that point, so most of them are going to end up in the hospital, and there'll be an opportunity.
Let's stop there. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at the Mint Museum, presenting Beyond Craft Decorative Arts from the Leatrice S. and Melvin B. Eagle collection, highlighting important studio objects made from the mid-1960s to the 2000s, mintmuseum.org. There are more than 100 ballot initiatives in 41 states on issues like gay marriage, gun control, marijuana, and the minimum wage. And Diane Rehm and her guests will be talking about who is funding these initiatives and what they mean for the American political process, coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show here on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's your shot. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Hi, this is David Greene. Now, many of you know my voice really well. Some of you probably wake up to me. I mean, who knew that one of the perks of this job was all this pillow talk? Well, since you and I are close, I'm going to make a bold suggestion. When it's time to unload your current car, instead of trading it in, why don't you donate it to this station? Believe it or not, we can turn it into Morning Edition, All Things Considered, or Radiolab. It's easy. Here's how.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about naloxone or Narcan, which is an overdose reversal drug for those who had an overdose as a result of opiate or opioid use, and a new law in North Carolina, which essentially allows you to call 911 and get medical help without fear of prosecution for the use of an illegal drug. Louise Vinson is with us. She's chapter president and national president of the Urban Survivors Union. Robert Childs and Ronald Martin are both with the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, and Dr. Stephen Wyatt is the medical director for addictions for behavioral health at Carolina's healthcare system. And I asked you an impossible to answer question in 5 seconds or less before the break, so I'm going to give you a chance to expand on what you were trying to say about that.
By having naloxone even available, people have a greater level of education around their drug use, and it is an opportunity, just like needle exchange, to actually come in contact with people that are using and be able to do some intervention, you know, be able to talk to them about appropriate use of these medications, including, I was brought to the Carolinas healthcare system to address these problems within our community, the Charlotte community and the Carolinas community, and that is to really look at what things can we do around prevention, what can we do around treatment. But if people die, you don't have a chance. So that's what we're trying to address.
So by bringing them back without fear of prosecution, using this drug, it gives an opportunity for a conversation about an educated medical conversation about what these people are doing to themselves and how they can reverse.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you wanted to talk, Robert, about the naloxone provision of this law that the legislature passed in April.
Yeah, so North Carolina has a really great naloxone provision, and what Senate Bill 20 does is it allows doctors and other prescribers who prescribe naloxone and the people who administer naloxone in case of an overdose, they're going to be immune from civil and criminal liability for those actions as long as they act in good faith, meaning that if I come across a drug overdose and I have my naloxone kit, I can use it without fear of civil or criminal liability, and it also allows law enforcement around our great state of North Carolina to use it in good faith. And so there's been great departments that have done it, and Carborough's about to start, as well as Pitt County Sheriff. And also, we've had a great expansion of community-based naloxone folks who are dispensing naloxone around the state. Louise and I both do it, and we've given out over 4,000 naloxone kits all over North Carolina.
To whom?
We give it to parents who have kids who use drugs. We give it to people who inject drugs. We give it to methadone patients. We give it to law enforcement officers who want a kit. So, and we've had 127 people call us and say, hey, I use that kit to reverse a drug overdose.
So the law in North Carolina allows lay people, non-medical personnel, to possess and use this drug. And as I understand it, it can be injected. It can be injected in muscle tissue. It can be injected in a vein. It can also be spritzed as an aerosol in your nose. Is that correct?
Right.
Some states, and I guess we're one of them, allow ordinary people to use and have possession of this drug. How do you view that as a physician? Is that a good thing?
That's a good thing. There's no question. Again, we've pretty well, I think we've talked enough about the fact that it does save lives. There's no question. It's a relatively safe med. It's not The only real problem potentially is if the person is compromised physically enough to go into acute withdrawal can cause some problems. But
you know, we have had this focus on alcohol abuse in this country for quite a while now, and it's not uncommon for people to go to a party with people where they know drinking will occur with a person who is the designated driver, who essentially will not drink that evening so he can drive his friends who are drinking home, or her friends who are drinking home. Is there a difference in having a party where people ingest these opiates and opioids to the point where they might be overdosing, as long as there's a designated driver, someone not taking part, who has this kit? And if that's happening, is that not encouraging the use of it?
There's no evidence that anything like that would happen. Again, it's a different population. We're not talking about a group of people getting together to drink for a party. If a person is opiate dependent, anyone that's opiate dependent is going to be using opiates. They're not making a decision. I'm not going to use tonight. That's just not part of the culture.
So it's not like those marijuana parties in the 1960s where the joint was being passed around and somebody would say, no, never mind, I don't want that.
No, not if they're in that case, I mean, there is, and this is somewhat controversial, but there's certainly people that are dependent on marijuana and they would not pass the joint by. It just wouldn't happen. Okay. But that's certainly the case with opiates.
Now, I think, Ronald, you mentioned that if this drug is administered either by a layperson in a situation like this, that 911 still needs to be called.
911 and medical treatment is still a priority after any type of administration.
What's the likelihood of that happening? Even when a person knows that they're not going to be prosecuted because the law in North Carolina now allows that not to happen, what's the likelihood that 911 will be called in the aftermath of an overdose reversal?
Until the law is changed, and until there's stories on the street where people are not getting arrested and and they're not getting in trouble, people aren't going to be calling 911. Yeah. Because people learn through storytelling. People learn from what they hear. So one negative incident and nobody's calling 911 for a while.
Go ahead.
I think it's important to note also that these laws are in their infancy stage.
Okay.
So as far as the application is, how they apply, what's going on the street – it really has been a little bit over a year. So to get that overall change where people on the street that are overdosing and law enforcement, first responders, and everyone else are going to come together on the same page is not going to be an immediate change. So there, like Louise is saying, there's going to have to be some positive things that's going to happen where the word of mouth on the street basically starts to put out a message that it's okay to make a phone call or it's okay to –
The other aspect of that is that, as you're describing, over time, people on the street are going to recognize that one dose of naloxone doesn't necessarily save the
exactly.
person's life. So if they don't call 911, the length in which the opiate can be active within the system is longer than the Narcan. So the Narcan can wear off in a half hour to 45 minutes. If they have a huge dose of opiate on board, they're going to go back into overdose.
And a medical professional would know how to handle
that. Yeah, they'd go ahead and they're monitoring them. So as they see the respirations go down again, they go ahead and give them another dose of naloxone. So if they didn't have more naloxone on board or they're really afraid, they're not monitoring them, they leave them in the bedroom and then they come back a few hours later and they've passed.
Are people who are ingesting this really in the best frame of mind to administer it?
There's a great study by MMWR showing that there were about 10,000 drug overdose reversals by community folks, and most of them were active injection drug users.
So there are people like you on the street. There are people like you on the street, Louise, who are in communication with these communities of users. You're helping to get the word out about not only about this law, but about Narcan. What has been the impact of it?
And people's lives are saved. And when you save people's lives, they have the ability to change. I think the doctor said that. You know, if people die due to a drug overdose, there's no potential that they can live, you know, good lives and be active members in the community. You know, nothing changes if you die.
It creates an opportunity.
You know, it creates an opportunity for change. And I mean, I've just been a witness to really hundreds of overdose reversals. And so I've gotten to see people's lives change.
Ronald, you're a former police officer, and you say that the war on drugs has failed and that we are in the midst of an historic change of attitude by law enforcement personnel regarding drug reform. What's driving that? Just the fact that people realize, frontline people know it doesn't work, the war on drugs?
I think the results historically speak for themselves. It's been 40 years of nothing has changed. Nothing at all has changed. There's been a multitude of people that have been arrested. Their lives have been changed to the negative, and we have not moved one step closer to resolving the issue as far as drug addiction, or for that matter, just the impact of drugs on various communities. So as we move forward, I think the law enforcement community is starting to recognize that it is more of a medical issue. It is more of a public health issue that needs to be addressed. So therefore, let's approach it with a different model.
You mentioned some other police jurisdictions in the state, Robert, where the police officers are carrying these kits around, these Narcan kits. Mecklenburg County is not one of them.
Why not? We have met with some officials about it, but there hasn't been any movement. But it is also larger.
Is there some question about the efficacy on their part that they have, or what's the holdup?
Well, it's still also brand new, so it's only two departments have started it. But if there's any Mecklenburg County Sheriff or Charlotte police officers out there who are interested, I'm willing to help you get through that process. You know, give you sample policies and procedures and help move your department. I've trained a lot of the members of Charlotte PD through CIT trainings, and they're very, very supportive of it. And they're very interested in carrying naloxone, because if you carry naloxone, you save lives. And I know a lot of officers actually get PTSD from seeing so many people die in front of them. So it's also a tool to prevent, you know, officer burnout, prevent officers from getting post-traumatic stress disorder, and have them be part of the community solution to saving lives.
Let me reiterate one point that the doctor was making. There is minimal downside to the use of this drug, using Narcan, which means that it's relatively harmless. I believe it's fair to say. It's important for first responders, be it firefighters, paramedics, law enforcement personnel, to know this because they are, in fact, indemnified. There is no legal liability or civil liability as far as them using the drug, you know, on someone that's overdosed on drugs.
If they use it on someone and that person still dies, there's no legal indemnity? I mean, there's no legal ramifications?
There's no legal ramifications.
If this drug is being distributed, and it is, to civilian, non-medical personnel for administering in cases of emergency, why do you need to train police officers in its use? I mean, everybody has a bottle of it and a syringe. What's the big deal? Louise?
I mean, no, not everybody has a bottle of it at this point. We would hope that at some point everybody does have a bottle of it, but that's not the case. And people use alone. You know, there's all sorts of circumstances where you would have people need a first responder to have naloxone.
I guess the question I'm asking is, if it's being distributed to parents who mm-hmm. have kids who use, and they know the kids use, and they want to have it on hand in case the kid overdoses in their presence, what kind of training has to go in?
So we do a variety of different trainings for different populations, including law enforcement and the public. And so you would want to teach them to recognize what an opioid-based drug overdose looks like, how to respond
to
it.
What does it look like?
Oftentimes a person's lying there unresponsive, maybe turning blue. They don't respond to a sternum rub. And so we teach individuals, basically if you make a fist and rub your knuckles up and down the center of the chest, and it's extremely painful. And if they don't respond to that, then we tell people to call 911 and administer naloxone.
Is there a way to incorrectly administer this drug and put that person's life at further risk than they're already at?
No, there isn't really. It can be delivered either IM or IV, so they either intramuscularly or intravenously. And as you pointed out, there's also an atomizer, so it can be used now as a nasal spray.
Let me share some stuff that's come across the web and from internet and Facebook and Twitter and emails. There's too many things to talk about. Bill from Matthews, just look at all the drug ads in the media. It is no wonder we lead the world in drug use. We got tobacco ads out of the media several years ago, which I believe has been beneficial. Why hasn't there been an outcry to do the same for ads for pharmaceuticals? You're a doctor. You watch the evening news. Every commercial is for a drug, every one of them. Yeah. If not a drug, then a car. Yeah. So
I think it's a good statement. Certainly money is the driver.
Crystal on Twitter, I injured my back at work and went to urgent care 3 times. The first 2 doctors didn't even look at me. They just wrote a script for hydrocodone. The 3rd doctor examined me and told me I had sprained a muscle and referred me to a physical therapist, which made me much better. After 12 weeks, I was finally treated like a person. The 1st 2 doctors didn't ask questions or even look at me. Is there a tendency in the medical community to just throw a pill at somebody?
Well, yes. I mean, there is. I would say that I don't want to be unfair to the medical community. I mean, most of the time, people are going to hopefully get very good care. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as was pointed out about giving 80 Vicodins to by a dentist, it does relieve their pain for a short period of time, and they've kind of taken care of that acute problem. It is one of the problems of the overcrowding of emergency rooms, trying to move people through as quickly as we do.
Dana emails, I have been an addict for 35 years. I have been on naloxone since 2007. It has saved my life. Tim on Twitter, once addicted, people consume the opiates in order not to get sick, and people cannot safely detox on their own. Most then go to heroin because it's cheaper. Is that true?
It's true.
Yeah.
And to clarify about the fellow that's talking about being on naloxone, I would imagine that's naltrexone, which is a long-acting opiate antagonist.
Well, he says it's buprenorphine / naloxone.
Okay. That's a combination of a partial opiate agonist and naloxone that's used for the treatment of opiate-dependent patients.
And I just wanted to add on to that. If anybody does want naloxone, they can contact our agency via nchrc.org, and we'll make sure you get a free kit. And we know if you put a lot of naloxone into a community via British Medical Journal that you can decrease drug overdoses by 46% in that community. Okay. So there's no more effective thing to reduce drug overdoses than by flooding the community with naloxone.
And to be clear, possession is legal. Use is legal.
Yes.
So you're not breaking any laws.
Correct. All you're doing is saving lives.
That's Robert Childs, Executive Director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. Ronald Martin's a law enforcement safety advocate with that organization. Louise Vinson is Chapter and National President of Urban Survivors Union. And Dr. Stephen Wyatt is with Carolina's healthcare system. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.